today on Against the Grain. Despite the precariousness that it creates, why does capitalism survive? Radical theorist Silvia Federici has spent a lifetime reflecting on that question. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll be joined by Federici to discuss how capitalism works and what keeps it going, including the role of dispossession and the place of women in reproducing the working class. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism has now been with us for half a millennium, and many of us have a hard time imagining it going away. Yet our sense of the instability of capitalism has increased, and the fissures in the edifice have become more apparent. What exactly keeps the system chugging along, despite the myriad ways it seems to grind down the key elements in its reproduction, that is, human beings and nature? How does capitalism keep enduring? To talk about that question, and particularly the role of female paid and unpaid labor in the process, today I'm joined by the renowned Marxist feminist thinker and activist, Silvia Federici. She's the author of a number of books, including Caliban and the Witch. Originally from Italy, she was one of the founders of the Wages for Housework campaign in the 1970s. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have a connection to PM Press, which has published her work. Silvia, let me begin by asking you, what is essential for capitalism? What is essential for its survival?
What has been essential, a number of things have been essential for capitalism, you know, which can be perhaps reduced to two main categories, you know, very roughly. You know, one is dispossession. You know, it's very crucial for capitalism to capture, lay its hand, control, privatize all the means of reproduction that people have, everything that is basic for the reproduction of our lives, you know, the lands, the forests, the waters. And if you look at the history of capitalism, you see that they have pursued that, you know, incessantly. And in fact, this is really one road, you know, one path that, you know, they have never swerved from to this day. In fact, if anything, you know, that process of dispossession has continuously accelerated and today proceeds to a pace that is devastating. And it is, in fact, one of the main struggles in the planet, particularly in the so-called third world, you know, places like Latin America, Africa, you see it. Entire regions are being concessioned to mining companies, to companies building hydroelectric plants. And capitalism needs that because that's the basic condition to extract living labor, to accumulate wealth, to force people to accept any kind of exploitation, you know? And that, you know, that I'm afraid they have been very successful in that process, you know. And of course, there is a whole other dimension to this dispossession. You know, there is a Mexican feminist writer, you know, beautiful feminist writer. It's Mina Lorena Navarro, you know, who has written a book and done a lot of work on, you know, investigating, studying struggles for the defense of the territory and the common goods. And she speaks of multiple levels and dimensions of dispossession. It's very important because when you dispossess people of their means of reproduction, you're also dispossessing them from the knowledges they have accumulated. To lose the land, also lose many, many knowledges attached to the cultivation of the land. You also dispossess them from the, what she calls, political dispossession, the capacity for self-government. You know, of communal solidarity, the capacity for self-government and decision-making. So that's one level. The other level the other category, which I think has been crucial, and it's a project that capitalism has built upon from its very beginning, which is, you know, dividing people, creating hierarchy, and creating different experience that appears as not communicable. And so the systematic way in which capitalism, the capitalist class, has separated the colonized from the non-colonized, the enslaved, and the wage worker, women and men, you know, those who work for the wage and those who work for perform labor that is unpaid. So particularly through the use of the wage relation and the differential between wage and non-wage. You know, capitalism has built a whole complicated structure and the multiple layers of racism, sexism to justify, you know, forms of exploitation that cannot be justified according to what capitalism projects as its norm. So I think that to this day, you know, those, let's call them project, better conditions of existence. These are the condition of existence of capitalist society. And it's a way to trace the continuity. These are structuring elements of capitalist development in all of its phases.
I'd like to ask you more about the ways that capitalism divides people, but let me focus for a moment on the first point you made about dispossession and the centrality of dispossession for capitalism. How does dispossession relate to wage labor?
Yeah, dispossession very directly relates to wage labor. You know, it was by separating people from the commons, for example, that in Europe they create a wage labor force. You know, so people were forced to accept working, you know, for a wage, which means that you have no control over your life and no control over your reproduction. And in fact, for a long, long, long time in the history of capitalism, almost to the 19th century, and even later, people were able to reproduce themselves and not to be totally pauperized only as long as they worked for the wage. You know, for example, when they became unemployed, they would be left to starve. It was also as a product of many struggles that you have unemployment insurance. So, you know, winning the right to reproduce yourself, even when you're not directly working for capital. You know, so the wage. But what is not seen is that there's a whole area of work that it's not wage, but it's part of the wage relation. You know, it's still commanded by the wage. You know, I think, the feminist movement and certainly those of us who were in the campaign for wages for housework in the 70s, you know, we have been insisting that we cannot think of capitalist work only as wage labor. That when we speak of the wage relation, we have to see that it has two components. Because with a wage, capitalism commands much more than the work of the wage worker. It commands the work of his wife, or at least in the past, it has commanded the work of his wife, of his children, etc. So the wage, it's a way of extracting enormous amount of labor, not only from those who work in the recognized workplaces, but also those who work outside of them, you know, in workplaces who are not seen as such. You know, the kitchens, the bedroom, etc.
Well, can you spell that out a little more for people? And obviously, when you're talking here about reproduction, you're not talking narrowly about people giving birth to children and the labor force. You're actually talking about
absolutely
the conditions that people need to survive, and most of that happening within the realm of unpaid work.
Exactly. So when we speak of reproduction, the concept that we use reproduction rather than, you know, housework. You know, housework is part of that. But reproduction, the concept of reproduction evolved from the kind of reflection and analysis that began in the women's movement, you know, over the roots of this particular form of oppression the women experience in capitalist society, and out of the realization that this specificity had something to do with domestic work, had something to do with the fact that women were expecting to be house workers, mother, wife, etc. And we realized then that, yes, this is the work that in capitalism has been imposed on women. But that this work, it's not what it appears to be, you know, like a personal service to a person or to a family, but it's like actually a form of social production. Because when you look at it in all its totality, you see that this work is the work that produces the workforce.
So just to emphasize then the centrality, if these were to go away, if one day women said,
we're not doing it,
we're going on strike, what would happen to capitalism?
The whole system of, on one side, you can see capitalism would have had, if this arrangement, if they had not been able to impose on women, you know, with all the tricks and all the romantic love, etc., they would have had to provide an infrastructure. They would have had to invest an enormous amount of their resources in providing an infrastructure, enabling workers to show up every day at the job. And that means would have cut tremendously into the accumulation process. So women's unpaid labor has actually allowed to capitalism to reproduce the workforce at a very cheap cost. And so women have contributed to capitalist accumulation. And that's why, for instance, our campaign, one of our drive and motivating forces was to stop, you know, this flow of labor, free labor, given to the capitalist class.
But what makes it complicated is, well, several levels. One is that these are, although, as you're saying, we should actually see them for what they are, a relationship between us and the ruling class, in essence.
Yes.
But also these are intimate relationships at the same time. So if you decided that you were not going to go through the process of helping to produce the next generation, you know, that might mean not caring for your children tomorrow, and that would be unacceptable to people.
Oh, absolutely. This, in fact, has been one of the hurdles, one of the obstacles that women have always encountered. And this is why, you know, whenever they wanted to refuse, because what has happened is that in reproduction work, you know, you have both the reproduction of your own life and the life of the people you care for, and then the reproduction of capital. And for us, I think it was extremely, you know, one of the challenges was how to disentangle the two. And we thought that with our analysis and our struggle, we in fact contributed to this disentangling, in the sense of seeing that, yes, you know, housework reproduces the family, but reproduces children as future worker. Also puts, you know, that within housework there is an expectation of disciplining the future generation, you know, to accept certain work conditions, to accept limits, you know, on their desire, on their possibilities. And so we began to see and articulate a viewpoint where our liberation was also connected to the liberation of our children, where in a sense beginning to refuse those aspects of the work, and this is the disentangling, refuse those aspects of the work that in fact were a chain on us and also on our children. And, you know, refusing, for example, the whole idea of reproduction as sacrifice. You know, that, oh, you know, the way we have been defined as beings that do not have a right to an existence for themselves, but their existence is only instrumental to benefit other people, you know. And so the sacrificial mother who gives everything for the future of the children. We refused that, and I think it was very liberating for us and liberating for our children, because many of us had also suffered from, you know, the consequences of that sacrifice. where the fact that your mother, for instance, gave up your life for you, as they were expected to do, the ideal housewife who gives her life for her children. You know, often the children had to pale back, you know, in terms of giving a life. So we prefer a relationship where we saw us and our children as struggling together, and where we refused to think of life and building a future on the basis of, giving up our possibilities, giving up our creativity, and seeing that the renunciation of possibility and creativity was also a chain on the children that we had.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with feminist thinker Silvia Federici. So we've been talking about the division of work between waged and unwaged as it existed really in a time that now has closed, which is up until the early 1970s, where you saw the emergence of neoliberalism and there was a real shift that went on. And now, rather than having the prototype of the family being the father who goes off and gets the wage, and of course we're talking about heterosexual couples here, and the mother who stays at home and does the unpaid labor, you have all sorts of different configurations of families, yes. But you have situations where most people are expected, particularly most women, are expected to do both. They're expected, yes, to do wage work and unwaged work, despite the fact that hours have increase for waged work, at least in the United States. What does that do to this dynamic?
Yeah, what it does to this dynamic, I think, first of all, it has led to an amazing crisis of reproduction, because the recruitment and of women in the wage workplace, you know, has not been compensated or has not led to the creation of services, for example, daycare, care for the elderly. In fact, actually, the opposite, you know. And you know, because of the dismantling of what used to be called the welfare state in the 80s and 90s, with the globalization process, neoliberalism, what you find at the very moment, you know, when the need for those services, you know, peaked, and those services were cut, which also means that the wages that women have earned and are earning, you know, have to subsidize now, you know, buying those services, you know, through the market, which means that actually the hope that working outside the home for the wage will give a substantial autonomy to women, economic autonomy, is in many cases revealed to be an illusion. Surely there is a limited number of professional women who have benefited, but nevertheless, for the great majority, economic autonomy is still a dream. So I think that what has happened is that, in fact, you know, now you have women with a work week that it's extremely, extremely extensive. It's a work week that reminds us of the Industrial Revolution, when people work from sun up to sundown, you know, coupling paid and unpaid, and not having any possibility of recuperation, any recreation. And, you know, I mean, this has become a mantra with me, the fact that life expectancy for women has declined, that now women are expected, basically, the average working class woman lives today 5 years less than her mother, which I think is a very telling sign of the stresses women are living with, and, you know, the consumption of antidepressants and so forth. They're all part of that syndrome that we have not been able to gain. You know, yes, maybe some autonomy from men, some limited autonomy from men, but at the same time paid at a very, very high cost. And this dynamic, however, of the relation between wage and unwaged labor continues. You know, even though a lot more women now work outside the womb and have access to a wage, the total amount of unwaged labor, you know, has actually grown over the last few decades. Because now we see that forcing people to work for no pay has extended beyond the housework, beyond the home. And we find students, for instance, doing an immense amount of unpaid labor under the guise of internship. You know, now I understand that it's beginning to go down to the high schools, the high school students, you know. Many, many artists, people working into cultural projects, the arts, are beginning now to make connection between their situation, you know, and the situation of house workers. You know, where because they are doing artwork, you know, something that is supposed to be a reward in itself and creative, you know, they are often, you know, pressured to do an enormous amount of unpaid labor. So I think that the issue raised in connection with housework are still there, are still crucial.
One of the strengths of capitalism seems to be that it has the ability quite frequently to co-opt movements from below. Because you're saying here there was the hope that when women went into the workforce in the 70s and the political demands to open up the workforce further to women to go into the workforce, that social relations would be transformed, the workplace would be transformed. But what instead happened was not that there was no positive legacy from those struggles, but that you had a situation where preceding that, a family could get by on one wage, and then with both wage earners in the workforce, you ended up with a situation where people needed, because income stagnated, you needed those two wages to survive. Was that just kind of a fluke of history, or is that something that is one of the strengths, even though obviously we're critical of it, of capitalism itself?
Well, there's several things involved, you know, because I think important to recognize that one reason also those expectations were frustrated is that at the moment when, you know, women are strategizing and women are entering the so-called workforce, because I think the workforce is broader.
Yes, indeed.
But, you know, capitalism itself was undergoing a tremendous transformation, you know. And so there's something very strategically misplaced, you know, in women's hope to, you know, gain more social power, you know, by entering directly the wage relation, you know, at the moment in which, in fact, capitalism, certainly in the United States, the capitalist class was dismantling the wage workplace. You know, that's what globalization was about, exporting work, dismantling the welfare state. So, you know, women enter, for instance, factories, offices, where in the midst of massive layoff, you know, negotiated givebacks by the unions. So that, I think, is important to keep in mind, because immediately put a cap on what they could obtain, what their struggle, immediately reduced the possibility of them making any change and instead being involved in a day-to-day struggle to save their jobs, you know, so that in fact, from a broad movement, they had this perhaps not well-defined, but broad idea of subverting society, changing things from the bottom up. You know, we come down to women involved, many women involved in very local struggle on their job, you know, to defend the job because they're moving the factories to the Maquilas or to the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. That, I think, is extremely important. And I think it was a miscalculation by the women's movement, because by the mid-70s, you could already see that there was a major capitalist crisis. In other words, capitalism was refusing investment as a way of disciplining a global workforce that at the time was on the move. Anti-colonial struggle, industrial workers, blue-collar struggle, wildcat strike, you know, in the United States, people fighting for time out, you know, refusing factory work, women's movement, student movement, anti-war movement. So it's in that, you know, it's to counter that powerful movement, or they begin to culminate and reinforce each other in the mid-70s, and from the 60s to the 70s, that the restructuring of the global economy, restructuring of the workplace is accomplished. And I think that strategically was a mistake for women not to see that. The other side also, and for me an important point, is that, you know, our argument in the 70s was that if unpaid labor, domestic work, is the main terrain of exploitation for women, this is where we have to concentrate our struggle, you know, in order to renegotiate every aspect of our life, in order to renegotiate how we go to work outside the home, you know, how do we give birth, procreate, raise children? How do we live our sexuality? We thought that in a way, the place on which we could best fight for that change that will cover all the different dimensions of our life, was to tackle the kind of the question of reproductive work. Because we felt this is something that in different way we all have in common, even though we experience it in different way, obviously, but it's a kind of common denominator. And this expectation that we are unpaid workers, it's something that weakens our position with respect to the state, with respect to the capitalist class. That we in a sense, confront the world from a position of weakness, in which we are expected to do a huge amount of work that is totally invisible, totally taken for granted, totally naturalized, and we carry that on our shoulder. And going at work outside the home does not eliminate that, but in fact only weakens us, because those who employ us know that we need that money, know that we are used to work for free. And so we enter the workplace, the wage workplace, in a position of weakness. And so, unfortunately, I think that, you know, by the mid-70s, also encouraged by the fact that, you know, capital opened the door of the workplaces with Title VII or education, et cetera, because they needed to resolve, women resolved the capitalist crisis, the crisis of labor that capitalism was facing in the mid-70s. The entrance of women helped resolve the crisis. What happened? Part of the work, they exported it to across the border, you know, to areas of the world that were being pauperized through the debt crisis, which was artificially created. So they exported a lot of the work, you know, mostly on the shoulder of women, you know, in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, and then opened the door to women through and restructuring the local economy around services and so forth. And we provide the cheap labor, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. We provided the cheap labor that reactivated the capitalist machine. And I think that's the predicament we're still in. You know? And I hope that, you know, rethinking may be the new generation who look back at the history of the women's movement. The new generation can learn, you know, from those mistakes.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the feminist thinker and activist Silvia Federici, author of a number of books, including Caliban and the Witch. And during this hour, we're talking about why capitalism survives. And Sylvia, you've been talking a lot about the role of women's unpaid labor in shoring up capitalism and the ways that it has made women vulnerable, especially under the neoliberal form of capitalism, in terms of being able to contest social relations. What has been the effects of what you've been describing on women's ability and the ability of the working class more broadly to come together and oppose capitalism and to come together and oppose neoliberalism? Do you feel like the state of affairs that has predominated for the last 40 years has been particularly effective in limiting our ability to come together collectively?
Yeah, I think it has. I think that, rather than the great, process of unification that we had envisioned, there's been, in fact, a division, a process of division. And I can see it in so many ways, I mean, first of all, already in the 1970s, for me, one of the great, great strategic mistakes that the feminist movement has made, and that already was very clear to myself and many others at the time, was not to have opposed the attack on women who were on welfare, and to have been practically silenced, with few exceptions, in front of the criminalization, demonization, vilification of women on welfare, and which I think affected not only very negatively, of course, many women, but who were receiving some subsidies for going to their work of supporting children in the absence of an income coming into the family. But that silence and acceptance of the vilification or indifference in front of it, as in fact, I think, had a negative effect on all women, because what was not seen by the feminist movement is that welfare was a feminist issue. It was an all women's issue, not only an issue for the women who were receiving the subsidy, because as the slogan of many welfare women was, every mother is a working mother. This money that we receive is not a charity, Raising a child is work. And it's work that we do not just for ourselves and for the children, but it's work from which society will benefit, because these children will be contributing to society, etc. And this, in fact, we at the time said, welfare is the first form of wages for housework. And we have to stop calling it charity. We have to stop pretending, as the media were doing, as the politicians were doing, that these women are non-workers, parasites, living off, they honestly earn money of the working class, the so-called working. They are the working class. And we rejected the idea, all the propaganda about working mothers. Yes, every mother is a working mother, said not only the woman who works for a wage. I think that this was a major mistake, because, in fact, as we saw, the woman on welfare, the vilification of the woman on welfare became a prop to justify, for example, the ongoing increasing attack on the black community. Then the woman on welfare becomes, within a few years, the crack mother. The mother produces crack babies. And so there is, Dorothy Roberts, one of the main feminist thinkers in the black community, has so powerfully put, in a book, Killing the Black Body. There was, from all through the 80s, there's a construction of a gallery of female villains, where the welfare woman is the first, and then you have the crack mother, and then, the representation of women black women has been unfit mothers, has been promiscuous, and so on, which has supported, you know, the whole process also of mass incarceration. You know, this idea of the black woman is central to the creation of a dysfunctional family, dysfunctional community. So I think that was a major, major mistake. Also, the fact that women went to work outside the home at the moment in which services were dismantled as also meant, and that there was not an adequate struggle, you know, to fight on the terrain of reproduction, has meant that a lot of reproductive work eventually was done by immigrant women. Immigrant women forced to migrate, you know, because of the politics of agencies like the World Bank or the Federal Reserve of the United States that raised the interest on the dollar, creating a debt crisis. And through the debt crisis, a whole system of reforms that pauperized a lot of people, so that in response to the poverty, you had lots of women migrating to becoming domestic work. So there is a whole, the solution to the housework crisis is in fact the creation of a class of women, you know, who are more than institutionalized in the home. Because being immigrant, many times undocumented, you know, they faced the level of abuse that domestic nation, domestic workers had not, you know, confronted. So this was another division, you know, the working mother outside, the woman who goes to work outside the home, the immigrant domestic servant. Another division, it's now around the issue of sex work, because we now have a division within the feminist movement around that issue, you know, with forgetting that the sex worker movement really began almost as an offshoot of the women's movement, you know. It was the women's movement, I think, that gave the power to many prostitutes to say sex is work. We are sex workers. You know, when we began to analyze the condition of housework and realize that sexuality had been turned, in our case, into a service to men, into a sort of work. There was part of the job description of being a housewife, to the point that rape in the family has never... the control of the man over the woman's body in the family has never been seen as a form of rape, and women had to fight. So the prostitute movement, you know, in fact, the definition of the change from the concept of prostitute with all its negative cargo into sex work, it's really coming in the wake of the feminist movement, you know. But today there was a whole division, because many women now see, you know, sex work as particularly degrading, and I think that this is really has been another crisis for the women's movement, because we are certainly not going to celebrate, you know, selling our bodies. And this is undoubtedly a form of exploitation. At the same time, you know, there are many, many, many other forms of degrading work that are not the recipient of the same amount of criticism that many feminists are directing against sex work. So I think that all this, It's symptomatic of a crisis within the women's movement.
I'm Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm speaking with feminist thinker Silvia Federici. Well, so you're describing, even amongst women, many divisions. And obviously, there are other divisions as well that are very deep and divide the working class. And for a lot of people, they wouldn't even think of unpaid laborers as being part of the working class. So there are so many divisions that beset us and that are even involve the way we even think about who do we join arms with. So given all of those things and the kind of restructuring of work that happened under neoliberalism, there are many different obstacles in terms of opposing the situation we find ourselves under. But there are also ways of thinking about the working class as being a kind of a large grouping. Historically, often the working class got defined very narrowly as industrial workers. So people even in particular industries, even though actually in the 19th century there were many, many service workers who were paid and then, of course, many more who were unpaid. But do you think there is something about how we define the working class that can serve to bring us together across our differences, or are the differences themselves just so pronounced?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that many of these divisions that have occurred, you know, among women, or the man feminist, you know, our division that in a way issue from an inability to understand or confront, you know, the question of how do we improve our life? How we change our life, you know, and by placing it in the context, you know, of a social system that has developed over a century, you know, mechanism of division, cooptation, exploitation. And I think that, you know, increasingly the feminist movement, and partially also because of this immense investment that by the 1970s the capitalist class makes to bring feminism, you know, under its fold, you know, with the United Nations coming in, entering into feminist politics, creating a new agenda, you know, using the feminist language, but to create a new agenda that cuts all the subversive element and reduces feminism to improving the condition of women, more equality with men, leaving the structures of the system untouched, right? Only opening the system to women without necessarily changing that has turned out to be a blind alley. And by hope, you know, I point to this division not to say that we cannot overcome them, but to point to the need of placing our struggle, you know, also between a broader context, and to see that, for instance, you know, as we struggle for acquiring more resources, more autonomy, to see, for example, how the wage has been used to divide people, which doesn't mean that we don't fight to have wage jobs, but it means that we cannot fight them in a way that, you know, can allow capital to use the wage against us or to use the wage to divide us, you know? And I think that there has to be some strategic thinking as to what are struggles that can broaden the basis, and what are the struggles, in fact, where they lead to a fragmentation of our forces, so that we may end up basically fighting in different workplaces, separate from each other, and try to rethink the history of the women's movement and see what in the history of feminism have been the issues that have been able to coalesce women. Even though we come with different levels of power, but to create common alliances, to create common grounds, I think that is still an imperative.
Well, we've been speaking about the vulnerabilities in some ways of of women especially, but more broadly the working class, in coming together to oppose capitalism, coming together to oppose neoliberalism. So we've talked about the strengths of capitalism here and neoliberal capitalism, how it's restructured our lives in various different ways. But what you're describing also sounds pretty unstable. And I wanted to know, in closing, what you think are the vulnerabilities of neoliberal capitalism that any sort of opposition should be aware of in thinking about how to organize strategically.
The vulnerability of capitalism is people coming together. The question is the importance of not seeing our struggles only in terms of opposition. I think that following on my principle that the vulnerability capital is vulnerable to people resistance, I think that the ability, to create forms of reproduction in the communities that enable us to resist, that bring people together. For instance, we see now all these town halls where people come together to oppose Trump, etc. Why can't we have the same town halls full of people, to discuss what we do with education, to discuss how we make sure that our children, not only about Obamacare, for example, about saving Obamacare, but raising the whole issue of health, raising all this that we see, this coming together that we see, to opposing certain strategy. I think I see the future or the political possibility in transforming those not only in oppositional moments, but in constructive moments, in moments that begin a process, a conscious process of reclamation of decisional power. Not only say, oh, no, we want a president that does that instead of doing that, but basically that begins to reclaim the power to decide what the different aspect of our life should be and begin to bring together people and pose the issue of how to overcome the decision, how to overcome the division that have been implanted, So, because I think that the work ahead, it's huge. But on the other hand, I think that what really weakens the possibility to confront the state, which is extremely armed, is exactly the fact that, people in a sense still expect the solution to come from the outside, rather than realizes that, this is a system that cannot give us a decent life, or can give a decent life only to a very limited number of people. And that if we are struggling, whatever struggle we are making, we have to pose the ability to change the system itself. And our negotiation with the state, our struggles with the state, should be a struggle that limits the power of the state, and should be a struggle that, for the reappropriation into our hands, of the different forms of wealth they have taken from us, and of the decisional power, the political power to make decisions. That, I think, has to be the struggle. Of course, how it is articulated, I think there are many, many grounds. I've spoken of reproduction. Another fundamental ground where women should be present is the struggle against incarceration. We cannot make any, and the violence, particularly against the black community, as well as violence against women, against this violence against trans, that I think has to be central. When I say reproduction, I also say, yes, that it's an articulation of the struggle to change the condition of reproduction. No more jails, no more mass incarceration, no to the death penalty. I think it's problematic that, for example, the feminist movement has not made that one of the central aspects of this mobilization. I think that is extremely problematic. The number of women incarcerated has increased by almost 800% from the 1970 to 2010. This is the last date that I have in terms of statistics that I've controlled. Most of them are economic crimes, you know, so-called crimes, right? Forging checks and you know, prostitution, selling some dopes, etc. Right? Clearly, you know, transgression related to the immense impoverishment that women have suffered. Right? And you know, black youth is being killed. Women and men is being killed every day in the street. Why there's not a movement as strong as the movement for abortion that says no? We cannot live in a society where with total impunity every day a black youth is being killed. No? So I think that this, the war, the issue of the war also, you know, the United States government is now preparing to refurbish the nuclear arsenal at the cost of $1 trillion, but actually will be much, much more. Imagine what could be done. Imagine what schools, what hospital, what healthcare, imagine what could be done with that trillion that is going to be used, yeah, to you know, terrorize. This is basically what it is about, to create a system of terror where nobody will dare to oppose, you know, the United States government fiat, because we will have nuclear submarines capable of reaching and destroying, pulverizing their society in a matter of minutes. I think this is a scandal. So I think that when I say reproduction, I say a commitment, right? A commitment to not allowing the state, you know, to turn the energy, people's activity, people's work into a production of death, into a production of profit and into a production of death. And instead, you know, use the knowledge, the experience that we have gained by the fact that we have been closer, you know, to the processes, you know, by which life is produced, and to chart another path, to create another structure of values, and to promote activities that are, in fact, you know, encouraging new forms of solidarity.
I've been speaking this hour with feminist thinker Silvia Federici. She's author of many books, including Caliban and the Witch and Revolution at Point Zero. I should say that I have an affiliation with PM Press, which published that latter book. She's one of the founders of the Wages for Housework movement. Silvia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks to you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
My name is Sasha Lilly. You've been listening to Against the Grain. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Thank you.